Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Worse Than War, we'll explore eliminationism and genocide in the 20th and 21st century. Then on the Scholar Circle, what are the requisite pathways to building a real peace between Israel and Palestine? While the 20th century has been called the mass murder century by scholars, our next guest says hundreds of millions of people are still at risk of becoming victims of genocide and other mass killings. Why do mass killings continue, and how can the cycle be brought to an end? That is the subject of a book called Worse Than War, Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. The author, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, joins us now. Welcome, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, I think I'd like to start with the spectrum that you look at, eliminationism, you call it. You have genocide on one end, but you incorporate all kinds of levels of really mass killings in various ways and also just trying to move populations out. Why don't you talk about this spectrum?
Well, when people talk about genocide, they sequester it off from everything else we know about politics and social action. These are treated as volcanic eruptions, uncontrollable ethnic conflicts that bend further out of control. And in fact, the underlying phenomenon is much more familiar. And because it's more familiar, in fact, when you understand it, we can actually do much more about it. And genocide is but the expression of a certain kind of politics, which can be called eliminationism, which is what it sounds like, which is when leaders decide that they want to eliminate groups of people whom they see as a threat or they see as being an impediment to their political goals, whatever they are. And when they decide upon eliminationist policy, they use a variety of policy tools, of implements, in order to eliminate them. They force them to transform themselves, such as force them to convert to another religion. They systematically deny them the right, the ability to reproduce themselves, and this is done through mass rape and other means. They incarcerate them in concentration camps. They expel them, and they kill them. And the largest such killings we call genocide. And so one of the things I argue in the book, Worse Than War, is that we need to recognize this politics and fight all kinds of eliminationism. And it's particularly the case that genocide should be seen as a form of eliminationism when one realizes that in every instance of what we call genocide, the perpetrators have been doing some of these other things that I've mentioned, failing victims, incarcerating them, preventing the reproduction, and so on. And so this is the underlying phenomenon. It's not been recognized as such, and it's not treated as such. It's not treated as what it is in the international political community and international security discussions. And so one of the things I want to do is to try to shift the discussion and bring this horrible and very widespread form of politics into focus.
Now, you looked over history, and you said the phenomenon is really quite ancient. How far back does it go?
It goes as far back as we know. In the ancient world, slaughtering groups which one conquered was a very normal thing. Slaughtering the men, many of them, all of them, enslaving the others. Slavery is a form of eliminationism as well. And it's been with us through human history. In the book and the film, I focus on the genocides and eliminations during our time because there's some particular characteristics of what has happened in our world. And most of all, I'm interested in the end in policy, that is in trying to put an end to the killing.
So let's start then with the 20th century. Start with the Armenian Genocide, what a lot of scholars called the first genocide of the 20th century, and put it into this context of your book.
But it's actually not the first genocide of the 20th century. There was a holdover genocide from the 19th century by the Belgians in the Congo, and nobody knows actually how many millions of people they killed there. And the Germans in Southwest Africa in 1904 set out to exterminate the entire Herero people and killed three-quarters of them. And so the Armenian Genocide is, of course, deserving of our attention and was horrific beyond horrific, but it is not the first. In 1915, the Turkish government decided to solve its so-called Armenian problem, which they understood to be a threat to the integrity of Turkey because Armenians were not very eager to be part of Turkey. So they set out under the cover of war to rid the country of Armenians by killing a huge number, expelling others, and they ended up killing approximately 1.5 million Armenians. As in all other genocides, the killing was not done in a clinical way. It was done utterly brutally. They often tortured their victims. And as in all other genocides, the perpetrators believed that what they were doing was right. They believed the Armenians, who were Christian, not Muslim as most Turks were, who were ethnically different, who were an alien people as they understood them, needed to be destroyed or eradicated or eliminated in order for Turkey to prosper. And so you find in genocide after genocide, the Turks of the Armenians, the Holocaust, Guatemala, Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, Darfur today, that the perpetrators are eager, willing, they do much more to their victims than they have to. In other words, they perpetrate cruelties upon them, which are totally unnecessary, even for the act of killing. We need to recognize this and recognize that these are not abstractions that are doing this. These are human beings who are making decisions to raise their hand and strike their victims down.
I thought it was really compelling, one of the breakdowns that you did, looking specifically at the Rwandan genocide. A Tutsi survivor had said to you that 20% killed reluctantly, 40% enthusiastically, 10% helped, and 30% were forced to kill. Now, do you think that's accurate?
We don't know what the exact percentages are, but it captures the sense of what happened in Rwanda. And we should remember, when we're talking about the killing in Rwanda, as in some other genocides or mass eliminations, we're talking about neighbors killing neighbors. And we should always keep in mind also, they're not killing military-aged men as they would in a military conflict. They're killing them, of course, but they're also killing women, and they're slaughtering children, often in the cruelest of ways. And we have much testimony from perpetrators and victims alike about the enthusiasm of the killers, about their cruelty, about their zeal. And in fact, in the book and in the film, I've interviewed perpetrators. It is just absolutely stunning to hear them talk about how they view the victims, what they did. And one of the perpetrators in Rwanda says quite clearly that his fellow killers, like himself, were killing people living in their commune. His fellow killers and himself, and he says, I include myself among them, did not believe that the Tutsi, that is the people they were killing, were human beings. And he said, if we had believed it, we wouldn't have done it.
One of the things that I think is potentially unique in some of these situations, and Rwanda is one of them, is that the Rwandans, the Hutus and the Tutsis, had lived together for a very long time and really didn't distinguish between each other until the Belgians had come and occupied it and started to separate them out and distinguish them. But even after that, same religion, same language, essentially same people, and there wasn't that much animosity until the radio, RTLM, started broadcasting these messages. How big of a role does the propaganda and the media play in your estimation?
Well, it varies from mass elimination to mass elimination. I would give, and I do give, a slightly different history of Rwanda than you have. It is true the Belgians fomented enmity between the two peoples as a divide and conquer strategy for their colonial rule. But it's not as if once the Belgians left in 1960 that this came to an end. An enormous amount of testimony that discrimination continued against the Tutsi in Rwanda, that in Hutu circles all kinds of prejudices were common and, in fact, were mother's milk, and they took the notion that Tutsis are snakes, as they called them, or cockroaches, devils in human form, as being just the way the world was. Now, they didn't kill them, though there were several mass killings before the great slaughter in which Hutu killed 800,000 Tutsi in 1994. The way we should look at it instead is that in many societies, including Rwanda, long-standing prejudice and hatreds, which simmer beneath the surface because the political authorities don't allow them to be expressed in violence, can easily be turned on. When they said it's time to kill, the Hutu understood immediately what they were talking about, why they would do it, and they went out and slaughtered their neighbors. And, of course, the messages they were getting that they were being threatened by the Tutsi over the radio that you mentioned and in other ways inflamed them and urged them onward. But if they hadn't believed what they already believed about Tutsi, they would have never done it. As Elie Nigarambe, the perpetrator I mentioned, testified when he said, if we had thought they're human beings, we wouldn't have done it.
Now, do you think that that is also the case in, say, the Armenian genocide and other ones?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the case in most. The great exception to that are the communist mass slaughters, where regimes come into power and have to inculcate a new set of views into the young of the country. But in most mass slaughters, that is not the case, that prejudices that exist in society are quickly activated when political leaders make the decision. But this is the critical point for policy, that genocides, mass eliminations don't happen just because there's great prejudice. You need the prejudice because you need a group of willing perpetrators, but you need the political leadership to enact a program of systematic mass killing or elimination. If that doesn't happen, you don't have a genocide. And in instance after instance, the decision to initiate the mass killing and elimination has been made by one man or a small group of men, and at a discrete time, and they did so because they thought they would get away with it, and it would bring them much more benefit than cost. Once you realize that we can change that decision-making moment, we can change their decision-making calculus, make it clear to them the cost of slaughtering and eliminating people will be far greater than the benefits brought to them. And in doing so, we can stay the hand of future would-be genocidal and eliminationist leaders. People talk about genocide, which is like some kind of volcanic eruption. It's not. It's politics. It's eliminationist politics. It's planned. Start looking at it that way and responding to politics with the tools that we know that work, which is other kinds of politics.
For example?
We have to, first of all, create an international system that is not permissive, which it is now. The international system says that as long as you don't attack people in another country, legally, there's not much anybody can do if you slaughter people in your own country or expel them or put them in camps. The UN and the notion of sovereignty protects states acting within their own borders. We need to change that. We need to stop protecting the dictatorships of the world, which are the proto-genocidal states of the world. In the world today, dictatorships are all potential genocidal states because the violence they use to maintain their power, that is the dictators, the authoritarian rulers, and those who support them, the violence that they use on a regular basis to maintain their power is never that far from being raised to eliminationist levels if the challenge becomes to their rule becomes that much greater, or if the leaders decide it's finally time to preemptively get rid of that challenge. And so we have to delegitimize these states, stop supporting them, and give them all kinds of incentives, the elites of these countries, to install democratic institutions.
Can you open your book with the United States and Harry Truman and his mass killing of Japanese civilians by dropping bombs, and how so many people made excuses for it? And then you also talk about the killings in Central America, which were largely funded by the United States. United States is a democratic republic, and it has perpetrated huge numbers of mass killings.
The United States has not bathed itself in glory. We can put it in a much more word. The United States has itself, as you pointed out, it has perpetrated mass slaughters in the past. We can start with Native Americans and move forward. A lot of that was done in the context of the Cold War, when the East-West conflict trumped all moral considerations. And I think that the United States and other Western countries have learned a great deal, particularly in the last 10 years, about what is right and appropriate and acceptable conduct in international affairs.
I'm really struggling with this only because I'm thinking about the Bush administration and going into Iraq.
Yeah, whatever one thinks of the war in Iraq, it's not an eliminationist or genocidal undertaking. And,
but it's still a mess.
We need to make distinctions between war and the out-and-out slaughter of unarmed men, women, and children, which is what takes place during genocide.
The end result of the war in Iraq did end up with massive killings, whether it was eliminationist or not.
But you see, here's the issue. The international realm is an anarchic realm, so you need to have agents to act well as opposed to acting badly. If you have other agents that you think would be better to stop slaughters in Rwanda, I'm happy to hear who they are. I mean, we have to deal with reality. You know, the problem with tempering the bloodlust is that we have very little ability to affect internally in the different countries what goes on. You need to stop the leadership of the would-be genocidal leaders with negative incentives and positive incentives. You want to try to do this as peacefully as possible. I'm happy to support any agents, international agents, but one has to who might do this. But the reality is that, as in Bosnia, it was NATO that had the capacity to do it and that actually did it, and it took the use of force. And the question people have to ask themselves, who might look askance at the United States or other Western countries using force, is do they think that the Western forces, the UN, the Belgian forces under the auspices of the UN, should have pulled out in April 1994 in Rwanda and let the people be slaughtered, which is what actually happened? Or should we have inserted more troops there, which we could have, and saved the people? Survivors of genocide say all the time when you go to talk to them, why didn't your country do anything to save us?
And it does beg the question about when to intervene and when not to. When should the U.S. intervene? When shouldn't it intervene? But at the same time, of course, under the auspices of what you said, battling the Red War, the U.S. set up dictatorships throughout Latin America, Chile being the perfect example.
Well, I don't want to pretend that democratic countries are angels internationally. Far from it. They have all kinds of self-interest, which don't serve developing countries very well at all. But with regard to killing people, neither the people nor the governments of the advanced industrial democracies, the democratic ones, have any desire to see people being slaughtered elsewhere in the world. So, yes, I agree with the historical account in my book itself, but I think times have changed, and let's hope that I'm right about this. And the thing to do is we have to create a prevention system. You don't want to intervene because once the killing begins, it's too late. Perpetrators can kill 10,000 people in a day, and we have to realize there are children being slaughtered and lives ruined, communities destroyed. And so we want a prevention system so that the would-be genocidal leaders will say, it's not even worth going there. I have to deal with my political problems in other ways. There's not even a discussion in the international political community within the UN and elsewhere of what a serious prevention system would look like. And if you can prevent one genocide, you will do more to save lives than if we cut the murder rate in half in Los Angeles in a year, which everybody would say would be a great accomplishment. I would applaud it, but it would be a drop in the bucket compared to the number of lives we would save if we prevent one genocide.
That's a perfect place to end this. Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, thank you. The film and the book are both called Worse Than War, mm-hmm. Genocide, Eliminationism, and the Ongoing Assault on Humanity. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What are the requisite pathways to building a real peace between Israel and Palestine? We'll explore next. Stay tuned.
Heal the brokenhearted, wipe away the tears, heal the soldiers' wounds and the children's fear, heal the shattered lives and tattered family ties. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the necessary steps to establish peace between Israel and Palestine? We explore the psychological, cultural, and structural components alongside the more discussed political issues. Irvin Staub is with us. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's the author of award-winning books, including The Roots of Evil, The Origins of Genocide and Other Group Violence, The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. Sami Adwan is also with us. He is professor of education at Bethlehem University and co-founder and co-director of the Peace Research Institute in the Middle East. He is the co-author of numerous books, including Side by Side, Parallel Histories of Israel-Palestine, Zoom In, Palestinian Refugees of 1948, Remembrances, and Participation and Reconciliation, Preconditions of Justice. We also have with us Sarai Aharoni. She is professor of political science and international relations at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She is co-author of Where Are All the Women? UN Security Council Resolution 1325, Gender Perspectives of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Thank you all for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. Irvin Staub, your work deals with studying why people resort to violence, particularly political violence, and you look at how we can resolve these issues. Do you think the situation with Israel and Palestine, and particularly now with Gaza, fits your model of the conditions for extreme violence? And if so, how?
It does. There are general principles in this, and there are also particular circumstances. In the case of Israel and Palestine, what started out was a conflict over land, over territory. But unfortunately, when conflicts don't get resolved, over time they become intensely psychological, so that each party comes to see the other as responsible, as morally bad, mistrust develops, and especially when violence enters, which has entered, of course, a long time ago, there is an evolution of increasing hostility. One of the things that happens in most forms of violence is that when there are no constraining factors, people learn by doing. Individuals and groups change as a result of their own actions. And they also change when there is reciprocal violence, when the other group responds with violence. So the hostility, the negativity increases over time, which makes resolution extremely difficult. This is a very important part of what is going on now. Another very important thing in most cases of violence is that each group tends to hold a destructive ideology. What do I mean by a destructive ideology? A vision for the group that would provide something positive for the group, but that identifies another group standing in the way. In the case of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, many Israelis, not all, far from all, but a substantial number, hold on to a vision of greater Israel, to recreating the historical greater Israel. Well, the Palestinians living in the West Bank are in the way. That's part of the territory of Greater Israel. For the Palestinians, many of them hold on to the old historical view of a Palestine that is a complete country, and the existence of Israel stands in the way of their vision of Palestine. So the very existence of Israel is a problem for them, and so Israel, by its very identity, stands in the way of this ideology of one single country, Palestine. And if I may just add also that historical wounds, victimization, suffering on the part of a group makes the world look dangerous and makes them feel vulnerable. And so, as a result, other groups are potential enemies, and they are likely to strike out against these others because they believe they need to do that to defend themselves. Now, one of the challenges over time is that woundedness could lead to a feeling of vulnerability and moving towards healing. And sometimes people, as they heal, their heart opens to others who suffer, and they are likely to be more caring about others. But woundedness in these cases, both for Israelis and Palestinians, became kind of covered up by a hard shell that we need to defend ourselves, we need to fight for our rights, we need to protect ourselves in the case of Israelis, we need to fight for our rights in the case of Palestinians. So there isn't the kind of openness that woundedness potentially could create. Instead, it contributes to continuing hostility. So these are some of the elements: historical woundedness, a destructive ideology, mistrust of each other, the conflict moving from material issues also to psychological issues, and issues of identity are all very important things that contribute to maintain the ongoing conflict.
One other thing that you had written about in your books is the cultural situation that either makes violence more fitting for the situation or not. How do you see that in this particular situation?
When I talk about cultural circumstances or conditions that contribute to violence, one of the elements is a history of devaluation of the other, which means that at times when there are problems, difficult life conditions, for example, or material conflict, then the other is likely to be blamed for it. Now, this historical devaluation has been present. It has been part of Jews and Palestinians from before the creation of the state to different extents, and it has intensified over time. And unfortunately, it is maintained. It is maintained in textbooks. It is maintained by the difficulty of considering the other situation, the kind of work that Somi Adwan has tried to address. And so that's one thing. But this other thing that I was talking about, woundedness, is another cultural characteristic. It becomes part of the group. Sometimes the group focuses on historical victimization, and that becomes part of their culture. It is part of their identity, and then they act out of that. Their perception of the world is shaped by what they have experienced and seeing the world as dangerous to them. So that is a cultural characteristic. Sometimes another cultural characteristic is overly strong respect for authority. Now, Somi Adwan would be more able to speak to this because he understands Palestinian culture better. I don't think that that is necessarily the case in Israeli society, although whenever is in a society under attack and in crisis, even when culturally their tendency is not so much to obey authorities, this tendency to obey authorities increases because of the threat to the group and people's vulnerability. They turn to authorities who then lead them and unfortunately all too often lead them in the wrong direction.
Somi Adwan, you've been prompted twice, one on the issue of culture and authoritarian following, but the other on the use of education, which you confronted with your projects. Let's first talk about those cultural and structural elements and then later how you've dealt with it.
The Israeli and Palestinian were engaged in this protracted conflicts that create a cultural of we and they, and we are the victim and they are the victimizers. And in that structures create so much inferiority in the weak group against the other group, and that developed a mechanism of self-defense and self-embracing of your ideology and your ideology and your ambitions that's really being hijacked or being used by authority or leaders who happen to hold or embrace these kind of ideology of defense. And the way to do that is to being so much authoritarian in their society, which leads to a mass movement towards this ideology and how to see the other as one group and the other is another group. In the case of Palestinians, we are really facing completely different situation. Of course, we are a very vulnerable society in all aspects of life. When we try to analyze the asymmetric relationship that exists between the Palestinian and Israelis, I mean, here you have a superpower versus masses of people. Here you have a very sophisticated, developed states that occupy the others. And in that sense, that creates a very cultural inhibition of the society, which leads to some disparity and that create in the individual and the collective, which try to get rid of these kind of oppression or their subjugation through means of defense, which we call defense, which sometimes it's called being violent or it's called being terrorist, but it's a defense mechanism that a society engage in this conflict, especially when this society is under oppression, that always become defensive and try to see themselves as in a course of victimization throughout the history. And now the victimization that Palestinian culture is dominant with now, it's not only related to Israeli occupation or oppression or policies, but also it really extended to the authoritarian that being presented in the international community. I mean, UN General Council, UN Security Council, the politics of international media, and how this being manipulated throughout the media. So here, the authority is seen from the Palestinian side in one way, feel it's a challenge if within the society to create their own leadership and how to follow a strong leadership and what's the power that this leadership could achieve in the course. And at the same time, the Palestinian feels that they are wrongly judged in the course of history. What creates the dynamics between cultural movements and cultural struggle in the direction of relating to authority in the course of conflict, it becomes so much layered and so much unclear.
The other thing I would want to understand, and something I've seen in your papers, deals with how these things are reinforced specifically through textbooks. And I ask this specifically because that's what you've been working on.
We started this project almost 12 years ago, and it was basically going through what information Palestinian and Israeli learned throughout their schooling and through their textbooks. The basic finding is very clear. In any societies engaging opposition and conflict, both societies focus its own narrative and it exists by itself, and it's always legitimate and it's always right. And the other side is hardly mentioned in the other side textbooks. So here there's no complete, so much focus on the self and so much denial on the others. That comes also with the issue of legitimacy. As we found in both schools' books, Palestinian and Israeli, there's a high level of delegitimization of each other existed. It goes along what was Irving saying, we are here and we have the right to be here, and the others is not at all legitimized to their claim and to their narratives. From the other side, you can find the dehumanization of the others in different forms, either as individual, as a group, and also the historical coexistence of peaceful coexistence between Palestinian and Israelis hardly mentioned in both sides' textbooks. To say the least, that each side textbooks fail to include in its own content any kind of material or any kind of information related to the other side. Here bring the children of both sides feeling that the other side doesn't exist at all, or there is no place for him or her to exist. Denial, dehumanization, delegitimization, and demonization is the main characteristics of both sides.
Saraya Haroni, give us an idea of how gender has played a role here.
I've been focusing on issues that relate to gender within Israel and the way the Israeli gender regime has been related, interconnected to the ongoing conflict. And I think that the gender issue connects the question of the conflict with the identity of the State of Israel as a democracy, with the question of militarization and what the securitization, this ongoing process of armed conflict that is being transmitted through generations, what does it do to women, to women's equality, and to their possibility to actually change this reality? I had focused on various aspects of the influence of the ongoing conflict on women's political attitudes, their participation, their vulnerabilities, the way their vulnerabilities, when we talk about Israeli women, we actually don't talk about a homogenous group. This is a very diverse group of people who have been affected very differently by the ongoing conflict. And Jewish women, Israeli-Palestinian women, women settlers, Mizrahi women, meaning women who are Oriental Jews, all of these different groups have actually experienced the conflict very differently. And these experiences have shaped women's political attitudes. And this is important because listening to women is a way for us to learn about transmission of knowledge. It helps us to understand the possibilities of people to dissent, to engage in political action that is opposition to whatever official governmental policies require. It tells us something about identity. Women's political participation also tells us something about the public sphere and the extent to which the Israeli public sphere is actually open to different voices, voices that are not identified with military power, voices that are not masculine, voices that do offer some kind of alternative. And we know that peace, especially in Western cultures, is identified with, to some extent, with femininity and with the ability to reconcile differences. Now, I don't really think that Israeli women are more peaceful than Israeli men, and we cannot prove that. We've tried to ask them, what do they think about peace? And we really found these striking and very depressing reality of the sense of complete disillusionment and despair. And women were not even able to imagine a future in which there would be some kind of a peaceful coexistence or existence. And I think this is really troubling. It gives us a sense of the actual way that people feel about reality and think that this reality could be changed. We did get a sense that the ongoing exposure of women and civilians in general to political violence, and I'm referring now to the period of the Second Intifada, which had affected Israeli civilian population, to the Second Lebanon War, and to the ongoing rocket attacks in southern Israel. Now, these have been clear experiences of insecurity. We found, I think, that one in every fourth Israeli woman had reported being exposed to some form of political violence. We think that this might be an indication to their political attitudes, which are currently quite similar to those of the Israeli government, which is a right-wing government.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the necessary preconditions to build peace between Israel and Palestine. If we have one in four women experiencing this, and we have on the Palestinian side this experience of oppression and marginalization, let's now examine what are the ways forward to creating not simply peace, but reconciliation and even, dare I say, friendship between Israelis and Palestinians. Irvin Saab, let's go back to you first. You've worked on both Israel-Palestine as well as Rwanda. Let's lay out what the most important aspects of reconciliation are in a situation like this that is so entrenched. How do we start?
These two people are in a really tough situation right now, given the level of hostility, the level of separateness, and attitudes towards each other, everything. And I think that a really important thing here is for what I call external bystanders seriously engaging. These external parties cannot create peace, but they can exert important influence to get people within the country to begin to move in certain directions. who are these external bystanders? The United States, American Jews, Arab countries. All of these need to engage, and ideally they should form some kind of a coalition on the outside to engage, not only in the political realm, but in order to exert an influence to generate internal constructive leadership and to get people within these countries to begin to move away from the right-wing hostile attitudes that are increasing in both groups. Now, another really important thing that relates to this is that for people in both countries to begin to initiate some positive action towards the other. I was talking about the evolution of hostility and antagonism and violence, but evolution goes in both directions. There is a lot of evidence looking at children, looking at adults who engage in positive actions, looking at groups, that when you begin to take positive actions, you also change in a positive direction, especially if there is a reciprocal interaction, if there is a positive response. So you have to begin to do this in order to generate some trust, in generate the opportunity to really create a difference. And other thing is, it's very important for leaders on the two sides to engage in persistent dialogue. What happened over many years now is that there is a very limited little dialogue, and then there is nothing for a very long time. So there is no opportunity to develop trust, interaction with each other. And so persistent engagement is important. I was talking about destructive visions. The two countries, the two people need a constructive shared vision of the future. What can that be? Well, one could be the vision of an economic community where both parties contribute and then both parties have gains. I am going fast one by one, and we may return to some of these things. Education is extremely important. SAMI is working with education in the schools. That is really crucial to create more positive attitudes towards the other. Also, education can have a role in creating more of a shared history. As he was saying, and as I very much think, what happens is that the two groups develop their own history in which the other is at fault and the other is to blame. There can be changes in these narratives of each group. There has been some change in Israel, for example, in that initially the Israelis claimed that Palestinians became refugees because their leaders told them to leave for the period of time while there is going to be fighting against Israel in the so-called War of Independence, or Nakba, the tragedy, as the Palestinians call it. So the only reason that they left was because their leaders told them to leave. Well, it turns out that they left for many reasons. They left because their leaders told them to leave. They left because there was fighting nearby and they wanted to escape from it. And they left also because they were intimidated and expelled by the Israelis. On the Palestinian side, the narrative is that they only left because they were expelled. Research has shown that that's also incorrect. So education about these things can change these narratives of each group and lead more of a joint history. Education can also have other forms. In Rwanda and Burundi and the Congo, we have been doing trainings and workshops for various groups, but also created educational radio programs in which there is information embedded in stories, or the education is presented in a straightforward way about what are the forces that lead to violence. What are ways to try to promote reconciliation between groups? And this information seems to have some significant impact on the population. So these are some of the many elements that are really important to develop more positive attitudes towards the other, to develop engagement. Let me just add that in terms of this shared history, education in the schools is valuable. Education through radio and television is valuable. But there have also been, in other cases, commissions, joint commissions of two groups that look at the history of the two groups, talk about what actually happened, come out with a report that begins to change the way people see the history that has taken place between the two of them.
Like South Africa.
Well, South Africa, or after the Second World War, there was a German-Czech commission, for example, to look at the history of the relations between the two countries and at other places. But let me just return to my first point and then stop. And that is, given how these two people are almost intertwined in, I'm sorry to use this phrase, but almost in a death embrace of each other, external bystanders who are truly committed, who are courageous, or American leadership who doesn't wimp out when they try to do something, move one of the countries toward positive action, and then there is resistance, maybe by the other party, maybe a subgroup of the society, and then our president and previous presidents, you know, George H. Bush tried to do something about the settlements, and when there was opposition to it, he gave up. So we need a certain kind of commitment in order to push and move these two parties toward more constructive actions in relation to each other.
Sami Yadwan, let's bring you back in now to talk specifically more about what your experience has been with the textbook project and the shared history project. How did that develop, and where is it now, and what have the results been?
Well, I just want to first make comments that what Sri was reporting about, there's one Israeli out of four women exposed to political violence. That's true, but if you look at the Palestinian, maybe four out of four women are exposed to daily political violence. Now, back to our project, what we try to do, how to create a change, how to move the education from continue perpetuating the conflict to be a means for peaceful resolutions. We have completely opposite narrative of certain places and issues and events. We thought to move this issues of denial of existence of the other narrative to what we call a dual narrative approach. We recruited Palestinian and Israeli teachers, and both sides start writing how they narrate their histories, and we put it together. So we put the Balfour Declaration from the Israeli side, how it's being seen from the Palestinian side, the 1948 war, the 1967, the peace accord. So we put these two narratives opposite to each other in a way to allow children in both sides, and teachers, of course, and communities and parents to know different narratives exist besides my own narrative. How to deal with these issues, how to create a discussion between yourself and your narrative in the light of the existence and recognition of the other side narrative. We never meant to move the children from deconstructing their narrative, but as a first step to recognize that there is narrative that exists, and it happened that the other side narrative is opposite to mine. We put in the book that we publish an empty space between the two sides narrative so the children and the teachers can engage in this discussion of narrative. We feel in our project, we call it a bottom-up approach of resolving a conflict, meaning moving generation of Palestinian children to recognize the existence of the other narrative and at the same time to live with these different narratives. There is no way for the Palestinian and the Israeli to try to forget or deny their own narrative. It's part of their national identity. It's part of their individual and society and cultural modes. So they have the right to live with it, but how to live with it and accept existence of other narratives. We succeeded in producing the 20th century narrative, both sides together in one book. Unfortunately, both ministries of education reject our project. So here we deal with the issue how to influence political leaders and how to influence the decision makers to take an action. We felt at a certain point that we failed to influence the political leaders on both sides. So we moved to what we call process-oriented approach, where we'd like to educate children as much as we can that in the other side there's a human part. It's not all enemy, etc. So gradually we try to open mind the children of both sides of this approach to both narratives to discuss it and to move on to reconciliation. We will never reach reconciliation until there's a recognition of each other's side narratives. Also, to deal with the future, we have to deal with the historical narrative. We cannot carry the historical narrative with completely in ignorance with the other side narrative and try to reach a political solution. We continue to train teachers because teachers are the emissaries of their narrative, and we have to educate them how to deal with these two opposing narratives, how to deal with them in their classroom, how to present it to their students, what kind of question they expect from students, how they should react with certain emotions when it comes. Because teaching history is not an objective presentation of the past. It comes with the human and emotional aspect. So how to deal with the issue, for example, when the teachers deal with the 1948 in the Palestinian side, that's the year of the catastrophe where dreams has been disappeared. That comes with sadness, emotions, and trauma. When you deal with 1948 from the Israeli side as the year of independence, where the dreams came true. So here we deal with a reality loop. We are walking uphill road that never ends, meaning that the daily reality has its own stake on influencing our work. While we try to open the hearts and minds of the children of both sides, there's a different reality what happens to them in day-to-day basis. Checkpoints, settlers' attacks, destroying homes, shelling with F-16. People are living in siege. So also Israelis are threatened, a feeling of insecurity. We have to create an educational process that slowly and slowly try to get the fear out and be replaced by a positive and promising futures. Otherwise, we just trying to put ourselves in a very ideal situation with raising high hopes, and at the same time we face a complete kind of frustrations. We've been criticized by many, by other people we were supported, that peace-building projects mostly become effective when political agreement has been reached, conflict has been resolved. But we end up continuing our project in continuation of the conflict. So it's becoming like walking on a minefield. We don't know when the next mines will explode in our face. And we lose energy because also the education process is a long-term thing. You don't see the fruits or the results in a short time. It needs time to ferment and blossom and to bear fruits. How to sustain people's hope and aspiration in the darkness of that time. But we were successful so far to produce these manuals, these materials, and we hope that many Palestinian schools, many Israeli schools, try to adapt it. And they are adapting it in contrary of the wishes of both side ministries. The other project is what the portrayal of each other in Palestinian and Israeli school books. There are indications that both sides' textbooks, there is so much improvement, you know, slowly developed inside of the textbooks in the level of dehumanization and demonization. The level of demonization, dehumanization, both sides' textbooks has really dropped down very drastically. Still, the issue of legitimations at the political level is very high. Still, you can find in the textbooks a kind of recognition of the other side, but not in its full pictures. And Ervin is right when he mentioned about the kind of shift in the Israeli textbooks. But we have to take this also into consideration in the political development of each side. Here, Israel is a state, developed more than 60 years. Now, Palestinians still are struggling under the occupation, and where the future is becoming much more darkness and grim. In a much more stable society, it's a critical aspect of their own narrative. In those people like the Palestinians who are under oppression, that's still the critical look at your own historical narrative is very, very minimal. The other thing which is completely a surprising finding for us is that it's very difficult to move the narrative from personal to collective. It's easier, of course, to adapt to a new narrative as a person, but when you move that to collective, it becomes extremely difficult. But still, we feel that a micro approach to deal and to change the content of textbooks from denial, from delegitimization, to recognition and accepting, it's a way forward.
Sarai Aharoni, let's bring you back in now. Given the hopelessness you have found expressed among women, How are attempts to maybe define or redefine women's roles within the peace processes or peace building, how would that be beneficial for both Palestinians and Israelis?
I'd like to start by thanking Sami for his insights, because I share some of these dilemmas. For example, the question of asymmetry and how to deal with the structured asymmetry between Israelis and Palestinians in general in a way that would be meaningful, in a way that will not just make each side entrenched in their own position, but understand the asymmetry in terms of the exposure to political violence. I know that Palestinian women have been more exposed to routine forms of insecurity. But I would like to say something about the bottom-up approach, and this is specifically relevant when we talk about women's roles, because women in Israel, as in many other places in the world, are not part of official decision-making. They're not a part of structures of negotiation, governmental structures of negotiations in Israel. These structures have been traditionally taken from military elites, political elites, professional academics, and these groups have been dominated by men. So women pick up the education or the resistance path or the dialogue path, that we need to talk more seriously about the question of this whole problem from the top down. This really takes a lot of courage, which is what I think I'm currently lacking. I mean, being willing to pay the price that any kind of negotiated agreement will actually have to imply for both sides. And there are very clear issues on stake. We know that the problem of Jerusalem, the problem of borders, the issue of the right of return of Palestinian refugees, the settlements, these are core issues that both sides are not really willing to compromise on. And there's no way to bypass these questions. The other side of it is, are both societies willing to continue to pay the price of the burden of living under this protracted, continuing conflict? The prices are multifaceted. These are economic prices, these are psychological prices, these are ethical prices, these are prices that come in various forms in terms of the ability of groups of people to flourish and to fulfill their potential, right? And this is the way I think both people would like to see their future, although they cannot imagine this happening. And so how do we move from this situation to a different future? When I look at the younger generation, and again, education is a key issue, it's clear that young people in Israel and in Palestine don't really know the other. And this is very different than the situation that existed 20 or 30 years ago. So there is a very clear degree of separation between Israeli Jews and Palestinians. Today, the majority of Israelis understand the prices. So the question is, when and how, and will they be willing to pay the prices?
Given that you study the gender roles, do you think that there's an aspect of this that could be changed with a change in gender roles, with knowledge that there does seem to be a movement towards inclusion of women? Is this a possibility of incorporating these more what you called feminine aspects, not using force, using diplomacy of dealing with the other in the future?
I think this is a very promising hypothesis. Women's participation in governmental official politics in Israel could be a good indication to the internal domestic struggles within Israeli society, which is not a homogeneous society. Currently, we do see some emerging women leaders, especially Shelly Yachimovich, believe me, Zehava Galon, and others, who have talked publicly about issues that deal with civilians, for example. These are very different women. Some of them are much more identified with the mainstream, masculine, or military point of view. Yet, there is a sense that Israeli women are starting to think about this question. What would it mean for us as women to have a woman leader that would speak a little bit differently about the conflict? And I won't raise any hopes here, because I don't think that women would actually believe in a major change, but rather would be able to buy a nuance here. Maybe we need to start from this a nuance, just to start negotiating. And yes, I do think that currently women would be more in favor of starting negotiations.
I would like to reemphasize the role of education in creating coexistence between both sides. And I would like to emphasize that violence is not a war, it's not a way to resolve the conflict. Both societies are intertwined by destiny that they should share this place somehow. Two-state solution is a viable approach, hopefully that could be reached. One-state solution with equal rights for each individual is an option that hopefully we will not have to think about. Both sides have to make a serious compromise, living side by side peacefully. Let's think about the war as part of the past, not as a part of our present situation. We would like the Israelis to teach about the Palestinian catastrophe in their schools, and we would like also to see the Palestinian teaching about the Holocaust in their education system. So to move even the conflict from being intellectual, political, rational, to be at the human and the social psychology level.
Sarai Aharoni.
I would like to thank Sami very much for his work. This is very, very hard to keep on working to develop shared understandings, even if they reflect different narratives in the current situation. At the same time, I know that over time we can see the fruits of some of these efforts. People like Sami and others give educators the tools to deal with these issues. When I meet women, I know that the question of tools and how do we learn how to talk about what has happened and what is happening is very important. So I agree that telling histories and telling stories and talking about what is happening now and what has happened is very powerful. And I hope that people who will learn how to tell these stories will also be able to change reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Irvin Staub is a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's the author of award-winning books, including The Roots of Evil, The Origins of Genocide and Other Group Violence, The Psychology of Good and Evil, and Overcoming Evil. Sami Adwan is professor of education at Bethlehem University and co-founder and co-director of the Peace Research Institute in the Middle East. He is the co-author of numerous books, including Side by Side, Parallel Histories of Israel-Palestine, and Participation and Reconciliation, Preconditions of Justice. Sarai Aharoni is professor of political science and international relations at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She is co-author of Where Are All the Women? UN Security Council Resolution 1325, Gender Perspectives of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Melissa Chiprin and Ankine Aghasian. And most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can always podcast us. Follow us at thescholarcircle.org and at Armudian on Twitter.
Let the wars be done. Live in peace as one.